Welcome to the Geek Night In, episode 29. I'm your host, Laura, and I'm here this week just with Gemma, just me and Gemma this week.
Hello. Well, parts of me. I think I'm like 60% here.
I think that I'm not none here. I'm still up on cloud nine somewhere. We've had interesting weeks this week. It's been very abstract ones. Not normal weeks, I don't think.
Yeah, by any stretch of the imagination, certainly in your case.
Oh, yeah. Should we get that out of the way? Because
it's awesome.
It is awesome. So I'm going to talk about my week this week. I did a couple of things, but like the big thing is this week I went to see Gerard Way in concert twice. For anyone that doesn't know who he is, he used to be the frontman and the singer of a band called My Chemical Romance, who sort of like they're best known like because of the fact that their third album had a lot of controversy surrounding it, and people were like, it's the devil's music, blah, 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 that sort of thing. Like, they're a band that did it, like, their four albums cover a very healthy progression through, like, the stages of depression, and it's a real, like, I really love them as a band. But, yeah, I went to see Gerard Way twice this week, basically because I like his first solo album. It's a really interesting, like, rock and Britpop combination thing, but particularly I was really excited because at every single tour date he's done on his like tour so far, like while he was going toured America, then he came over and started touring the UK, he's stopped in all of his shows to do a trans support speech where like he will just stop in between some of the songs, and it's usually about a third of the way in, and just be like, hey, so trans and non-binary people out there, you're awesome. People who know trans and non-binary people and who are nice to them, you're awesome. And it's just a really nice thing to see. So I was really excited about this. So I went and camped out like 22 hours early for the first show that he did. I was first in line, which meant I was like dead center on the barrier, and I had a fantastic time seeing him. And I narrowly missed out on getting to meet him after the show. Like, he said he wasn't signing, and then some friends of mine who hung around ended up getting to meet him for signing anyway. And, yeah, so I had tickets to see him a couple of days later again, so I, because basically, like, long story short, he was playing in London, I booked tickets, then he announced a date much closer to me, so I booked tickets for that as well, which is the first one. So I went and saw him again in London, and I was camping out, I think, for 18 hours for that second show, and, like, having been in the room for his first sort of trans support speech he did at the Southampton show, I was really touched by it. Like, I thought it was just, like, really beautiful to see him take time out of his show to do it and to see how his fans responded to it. And how, like, just, it's really nice to be in a room where, like, everyone is cheering, yay, woo, go trans people. And that's a really unexpected thing. So I, like, was trying to find something to do to fill the 18 hours that I had to wait. So I made a big A2 sign that, like, I was like, I was very close to the front of the queue, and I was like, okay, hopefully I'll get on the front barrier. And when he does his transport speech, I'm just going to hold up a sign to be like, hey, thank you for doing these speeches. It really means a lot. So I did it. I got on the barrier and I sort of held it up, and like, I wasn't sure if he'd acknowledged it or not, but like, I was like, okay, well, I gave it a shot. I tried to thank him for what he's been doing. And a couple of songs later, he like puts his, like takes his mic out of the stand and starts walking around. And there's a point in all of his shows this tour where like there is one of his songs, Get the Gang Together, where he will pick someone out of the audience, drag them up on stage to play tambourine with him. And I can only assume that he saw my sign or remembered me from like the couple of shows I'd been at the front of the barrier and like recognized me, and he just walks straight over to me and goes, you, I want you to play the tambourine. And I'm just there like, me? And he's like, yes, you, get up. So without like, I watched the videos that people have been uploading of this back, like within a second I'm on that stage, like I hop the barrier and I'm straight there. I'm like, nope, not wasting any time. He's like, ah, oh, we got a professional here. And I got to stand in front of 5,000 people in a sold out Brixton Academy, playing the tambourine to on stage with Gerard Way to Get the Gang Together, which as someone who's been a fan of his music for over a decade and has never had the chance to meet him before, it was like an absolute dream come true. And
I wonder, how would you describe the adrenaline content of your entire body at that point?
Okay, well, I'm basically, like, here's the best way I can describe this. I get up on the stage and I look out at the crowd, and it's like it's the biggest crowd I've ever stood in front of. And I look at them and I look at Gerard Way, and he hands me a tambourine, and suddenly, like, everything goes out of my mind. I forget how to walk. Like, if you watch these videos, like, I'll send a video to put on the Tumblr. I forgot how to walk. I could only walk if I did it, like, almost marching in time with my tambourine beats. I couldn't work out how to walk normally. I don't remember him singing any words to the song. Like, I don't remember the bit where he sang anything. I just remember being like, "Don't fuck up the tambourine. Don't mess this up. Don't mess up the tambourine." It's the important part. And yeah, I just jumped around and tambourine hit and shook the tambourine a bit at the end. And he was like, "Yeah, shake it, Laura." And then he gave me a big hug and he was like, "Oh, thank you so much. You did great." And then I got dragged backstage and thrown back into the crowd. I was like, did that happen, or did I pass out from exhaustion because of the not sleeping and of sleeping on the street all week? And was that a dream?" And I went home. I was like, "No, that happened. That was a thing."
Wow.
So yeah, that was like, it's not entirely sunk in yet that it happened. It's just kind of like, well, that's something off the bucket list.
The phrase "I can only imagine" has sprung to mind many times because I have actually been on stage with one of my favorite bands before, but that was kind of a prearranged thing because they wanted it's a band called Alter Red, who I don't think I've mentioned on this podcast before.
No, I don't think you have.
They're one of my favorites. They have an sort of an electronic goth alternative sound. And they have a string of three albums, although the fourth is in the works, on the concept of basically this protagonist who falls in love with a doll he's had created.
Oh.
It's there's a love of his life has basically been dollified,
Oh.
made sort of autonomous, and had the emotion and
Yeah.
feeling sort of sucked out of her, kind of thing.
Okay.
And just his descent into madness as a result of this and the doll's town that he built.
This sounds fascinating. I need to find this band.
Yeah, they are awesome, and they do play UK gigs reasonably regularly. They've also played Austria randomly, but yeah, they as part of a single launch, I think it was a single launch or an, it might have been an album launch actually, at Electro Works in London. They had myself and a bunch of other sort of fans and friends being dolls. So I became a citizen of Dolls Town from one of my favorite albums from my favorite bands.
Oh,
But
wow.
that was like 40 or 50 people at most in that venue. And even
Yeah.
then, I forgot when I got onto stage because they did this whole thing where we were in the audience, but we were holding doll masks because they have these particular masks which are part of their aesthetic. And at a certain point in a given song, we would whip these masks on and then just proceed to the stage and then start acting all doll-like and things.
Yeah.
But of course, as soon as I stepped onto the stage, I tripped. So during the middle of this like live
Wow.
performance, there was a I don't think it was actually heard because thankfully I was right behind one of the big bass speakers and nobody saw it either. But there was a very loud clunk and my toe hurt for like a week.
I see. I've done it once before in front of, again, a stage of about 40 people or so, which was at Alcon, I think it was called, which is a convention in Leicester that happens every year. I got to go up on stage with a singer that he used to go by the name Super Powerless, and he now sort of he people seem to know him now more. He goes on Twitter by Oliver Age 24 and does deliberately bad drawing tutorials and things on YouTube. But no, he used to be a musician under the name Super Powerless, and I absolutely loved his stuff. He's done some really beautiful songs about like dealing with depression that like I think are some of the best representations of how to like show someone else what to explain to someone what depression feels like. He does just a stunning job of it. But no, his sort of big single that he the music video used to like go on MTV sometimes was a song called "Wasted My Time," which was like a very simple like 8-bit song about I wasted my time playing video games, wasted my life playing video games, wasted my time, wasted my life, wasted my time playing video games. And then he plays his music on a Game Boy. He's lovely, but he pulled me up on stage to sing that song in front of about 40 people at Alcon, which was exciting. And also, I forgot how to make words. Like that was 40 people, and I forgot how to make words. I was just like,
Yeah.
ah. The only other music thing I've had, which I'm quite proud of, was if you look up on iTunes, Area 11 and their single of Heaven Piercing Giga Drill. There is a point about 2.5 minutes into that song where there is a huge shout of multiple people shouting, "Who the hell do you think we are?" I am one of about 15 fans of the band who got to have their voice on the "Who the hell do you think you are?" shout. So there is a song you can buy on iTunes that has me shouting, "Who the hell do you think you are?"
Oh,
which is
that's
quite
cool.
cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, Gerard Way, I have just been in a bit of a weird place this week since then because I'm just like, that happened. Like, I was reading, like, I read Gigwise. They did a review of that show and they mentioned me in the review. I'm like, that's me. It's
The
very
only,
strange.
I think actually the only thing I could compare it to was I was not in any way a participant, but I was in the audience when Amanda Palmer and the Grand Theft Orchestra played the Roundhouse in Camden, and that was the first time she did the thing where she sang "Dear Daily Mail." I don't know if you're familiar with that,
Yes.
but yeah, she brought that out for the first time because she'd written it that morning.
Yeah.
And this was the song sparked off by the Daily Mail having reviewed, I think it was her appearance at Glastonbury.
Yeah.
And they made some reference to the fact that she fell out of her bra or something, because she often appears on stage in lingerie. And so the song is basically about like saying that her boobs have fallen out of her clothes all the time. If the Daily Mail had simply done a Google image search. But no, it's because you're all misogynistic and this sort of thing. It's a wonderful song. But she performed this in a kimono
Yeah.
on stage, and she towards the end of the song she rips off that kimono and is just completely naked on stage singing this song about the Daily Mail and how they're ruining women's body image. I was in the audience, and that
Oh,
moment happened.
goodness.
It's like it's one of those moments where like, ah, I'm in rock and roll history now.
My musical like Daily Mail story is it's I was at a UK show for My Chemical Romance in I think it was 2006, 2007 or so, and this was like very shortly after the Daily Mail had blamed My Chemical Romance's Black Parade album on the suicide of a young girl. Like from reading into this story, like it was nothing to do with them. If anything, like they were a fairly important support structure for her, it seems. But like a lot of fans were like, no, you have completely misrepresented this band. Like that particular album, like it ends on a song that is like, I am not afraid to keep on living, is the entire crux of its final song. Is like, hey, suicidal feelings, you can get through them, you're awesome. And like people weren't happy that like the Daily Mail had blamed this girl's suicide on them. So I was at a UK show where My Chemical Romance got up on stage and created a song slash chant of "Fuck the Daily Mail," which this was like when they were just starting to do arena shows, so there was an entire like London arena full of just "Fuck the Daily Mail," "Fuck the Daily Mail," which was that was an interesting thing to be a part of.
Yeah.
The Daily Mail and their music reviews are not always accurate.
Indeed, but conversely, I suppose, yeah, it's interesting seeing the artistic responses that the Daily Mail has provoked.
Yes, it's nice to see people like responding to terrible critique. That's
Yeah.
something, but yeah, so I'm trying to think, what did I do other than camp? Like that was like most of my week was camping outside and seeing Gerard Way a bunch and then that thing. But
Well, I suppose by contrast, I was camping inside all weekend.
yeah, because you were doing Global Game Jam in
Yeah,
Sweden.
Well, sort of. I was actually not jamming. This is the first time I've ever been to a game jam and not jammed, and it's because I'm one of the co-organizers. So we have a non-profit organization that was founded a few months ago called Game Jam Stockholm. And as far as I can tell, we're actually like the only ones in Stockholm running game jams, at least open to the public. Because there are a few companies like Spotify is based in Stockholm, and they recently held their own sort of diversity jam, which we never heard about until it was announced, but that famously had a 50-50 participant, sort of men women kind of thing. But yeah, our organization is devoted towards making inclusive and accessible jams. So this year, I kind of joined the team, but the other two like core board members have been running Global Game Jam in Stockholm for 2 years beforehand. So they were continuing their good works in that. And yeah, it's I think I might have mentioned it like in one of our first podcasts actually. But anyway, it's in Stockholm at least, it's hosted in Tekniska museet, which is Sweden's Museum of Technology and
Yes, I think
Science.
you did mention them before in one of the earlier episodes, I think.
Yeah, which is really awesome in itself because we're in a museum after closing hours. We don't quite get to wander around the exhibits, although they did open some bits of the museum this time. So, like, I've taken a vine of an exhibit which was making TARDIS-like noises and had weird, glowy things, and was tracking my heat signature. Yeah, because science.
Because science.
Yeah. But yeah, and for those who don't know, Global Game Jam is, as the name suggests, an international game creation event. It's a 48-hour jam, and it's done on locations.
Yeah, so you go to somewhere like I know in the UK there's a lot of university campuses that do it. Like I was meant to be going along and unfortunately couldn't make it, but I was meant to be going along to Staffordshire Uni to go do their one they were doing in person. I know that the Google campuses in London do one and they do in-person ones. But yeah, it's a thing where everyone turns up to like big locations together that run it, and like you just spend 48 hours in a room trying to make games.
Yeah, and in this case, it was particularly awesome because last year was kind of it was a general game jam, so that the people there were a mixture of indies and students. I think there were some first timers, but this year we made a concerted effort to be more accessible. So we had more women turn up. We had a lot more first time jammers, and we also had some dedicated tabletop jammers turn up, which is something that Global Game Jam tries to encourage, but for the most part, it's digital. And we had some of the sponsorship included like a 3D printer company. So we had a 3D printing machine there making tokens for games and things. No, that was generally awesome. Oh, and we had a bunch of kids jamming as well. So we had like 13 to 16-year-olds coding games over the course of a weekend. It was awesome. But yeah, because I was one of the co-organizers for that, I basically spent a lot of time running around filling water tanks and making coffee and generally making sure that the jammers were happy. And that had a surprisingly nice sort of warm feeling to it.
Ah, that's really nice. Yeah, I've been doing a game jam this week. I think that's like one of the only other things I did this week is I've been working on a game jam game. I'm doing a month-long game jam, which we talked about this on an episode we did last week that we didn't air, but we're going to redo at some point. There's reasons for it, but yeah, I've started doing a game for a game jam called Jam for Leela, which, for anyone that doesn't know, is a game jam in sort of dedicated to a teenager called Leela Alicorn, who unfortunately took her life in December last year as a result of her living situation with her parents after coming out as trans. And it's an entire game jam dedicated to making sort of games that are about raising awareness of trans people and raising money for charities that support trans people. So yeah, I teamed up with Alex Roberts, who is at LexicaBob on Twitter, who like I first came to know her because she does a load of really cool stuff with making old games for games consoles. So she'll make things like she'll do 48-hour game jams and try and make like an NES game or a Sega Genesis game or something. And like get together dev kits to make these old console games, which is really cool. So we got her on board, as well as someone on Twitter called 8-Bit Goggles, and we are working on fleshing out something that I kind of half made as a draft of a Twine once. And we're fleshing it out, we're writing the other half of this sort of story and making it into a visual novel in Renpy. So updates on that, where I got to this week. We have fleshed out the other half of this sort of Twine story that I'd half written but needed someone to help flesh out the sort of other half of it. Like, initially I just sort of hastily gender flipped the other half of this Twine and was like, that's not going to work. I need someone to help me sort of rewrite that. We have decided on an art style that we can use that sort of serves the purpose we want to do, whilst also being really low, like requiring very little artistic time on an artist's part, that should be something to fairly quickly bash through. And we're working out how to do some mechanical stuff, because the simplest way I can put it is there is like one persistent choice throughout this Twine that we'd originally done, where like every single page of the Twine there is an option to give up that will essentially skip to the end of this Twine. And we've been sort of like toying around with different ways of like, okay, well, if it's not Twine and it's not all told through text, it doesn't necessarily make sense for every page to have this like this option. Do we maybe make it a menu option? Do we have it as something that comes up whenever there's multiple choices that aren't that give up option in the Twine? Do we then put it in? So yeah, we're sort of getting on with it. I think we're 10 days into a 30-day jam, so we're currently messing about with Renpy, because I don't think any of us have used Renpy before, so this is our first time. Like, Alex has some experience with Python, so she's working out how to do some of the like the things we want to do that aren't inherent to Renpy as a visual novel engine. And then we're just sort of working out, like, okay, who are we going to get onto the team to do art? What's, like, the minimum viable amount of art we need to do? And, like, how long is it going to take, roughly, with the sort of, like, art style we've got in mind, which, like, is very simple, black and white sketched, like, very rough. Like, you can see the multiple lines where it's not a single solid line to draw these things. No details on faces of characters, but we're going to have like color used for like to sort of denote emotion. So it's like sketch outlined characters with vague features, like imbued with bits of color where relevant. So we've got some rough ideas of things. So we're about 10 days into a game jam. So we're working on it on top of other projects, and that's fun.
Well, it's interesting you say that neither of you have used Renpy before, because I would say that is the core interesting thing about game jams, is that they're always about testing your boundaries. And it might not be as extreme as using a platform you've never used before, but they tend to be about either turning up and realizing you have a talent for something you didn't realize you did, or turning up and using it, this intense creation time. A month-long jam is still like a short amount of time to try to make a game, as I recently discovered with Anthologam. It's also an excuse to turn up and really just get stuck into something you might not have used before but have wanted to, which in my case is always the dark specter of Unity. One day I will actually try and code something for a game jam, but in my case, it just takes so much preparatory work that I haven't got around to it.
Well, it's interesting. Like, for us, it's like Renpy is not a huge leap from Twine. And it's just a case of, like, Twine was a really nice prototyping tool to, like, finally, like, finish working out this sort of, like, choose-your-own-adventure story. And then, like, yeah, I guess for us, that's our bit of stretching, is work together as a team, flesh this story out, work out how to do a couple of interesting things with Python and on Renpy, and then just... like, yeah, it shouldn't be, like, once we've got the hang of Renpy, it shouldn't be too hard to, like, transfer this story over and to start plugging art and things in. So, yeah, it's going to be fun. It'll be nice.
And it's up a nice fallback as well, given that one of the things that I certainly enjoy about Global Game Jam is it's not actually about completing something.
Yeah.
You can just have fun with game creation.
Yeah.
And if you go in with open goals like that, just trying to learn a thing, you might not actually make a game, but at least you learned Renpy.
Well, it's nice for us, because even if we don't finish making the game in Renpy, we'll have learned some stuff about Renpy for sure, and we can still put out the twine and be like, we put a game out. It's not the game we were trying to finish, but we've 10 days into it, we've already got a minimum viable product, which is really nice.
Yeah,
so
that's pretty great.
Yeah. Things from this week. Oh, I have another thing from this week to talk about. Do you have any awareness of a podcast called Serial?
I do not.
Okay. Now, I warn everyone listening to this podcast, when we record this, I have listened to 11 of the 12 episodes. I have yet to listen to the finale, and as such, I have yet to do further reading on this. So, there could well be things that I don't know about this series that, I will learn about in further reading that will change my perspective on it, but we'll keep that caveat in mind. By next week, I might well have a totally different perspective on it, but yeah, Serial is a really popular podcast that has been top of the iTunes podcast charts for quite a while, and that I've not really gotten around to, and I didn't have any awareness of what it was. Basically, it is a woman who spends a year researching a genuine murder from 15 years ago that happened in, I believe it was 1999, and she basically, she's contacted by someone who says, hey, I might be, this might be nothing, but, I want to talk to you about this person who was arrested for murder that I think, the case against him was incredibly weak and he shouldn't have been arrested. And it's a really interesting, from what I can tell so far, it's very journalistically sound, this investigation into having an open look at this 15-year-old murder case. To make it very simple, it's told like an audiobook narrative. It's told as a story, with a lot of other resources of interviews and things spliced in. But it's about this 15-year-old boy with Pakistani parents who was accused of murdering his ex-girlfriend. As it seems from what I've heard from this show, there seems to have been very little evidence whatsoever in terms of physical evidence or anything concrete other than the testimony of one key witness who was able to lead the police to the car that had the body in. Because of this, they were sort of willing to listen to him, and his testimony is pretty much the only thing that was there to implicate this person who was convicted of murder. And over 11 episodes, it sort of basically looks at the reasons that this case felt very, very weak, but also looks at the suspicious parts of the testimony that this the person who was convicted of murder has never been able to explain. And it's just a really interesting look at a lot of things. To summarize it as best I can, it does things it will look at the fact that there's one episode dedicated to an alibi that someone wrote to the defense attorney saying, look, I have an alibi, I can tell you where the accused was at the time of the murder, and that he didn't commit the murder, and the defense attorney never mentioned it in court, this potential alibi he had. There's phone calls that he can't account for because he was only asked about them by the police 6 weeks later, and imagine trying to justify, where were you when you had this phone call 6 weeks ago? It's I don't remember. So yeah, it's really interesting to listen through the 15 years later to have open interviews from this person who is in prison, serving a life sentence in prison, versus how other people saw what went down. It's really interesting. The woman who hosts it clearly has some biases in the convicted person's favor, but she's very aware of that. She will openly acknowledge it repeatedly. She'll say, look, I'm aware that I am invested in this more than I necessarily should be, and that probably peppers my opinion. But then she balances that out by about halfway through. She does an episode entirely dedicated to, here is an entire episode about evidence that really does not work in his favor and suggests he probably did it, that he cannot account for. And like it seems to be a fairly well balanced, very interesting look at this murder case that like somehow finds a way to make it an engaging narrative to go through, which is really interesting.
I like the idea of a bias or perspective switch being used as some sort of narrative device, because I know there are a few series and books which will change their tone for maybe even just a chapter or two or an episode.
Yeah.
But something like that with a shift in bias, like I say, yeah. It just sounds like an interesting technique.
It's really interesting.
It's just an opportunity as well.
Yeah, well, considering that it's like it's based on a real thing, it's very interesting to watch her, the reporter's perspective go back and forth. Because like, 1 minute she'll be like, oh, this witness's testimony is so thin, how could they ever convict him on just that? It's like, he clearly didn't do it. And then by the next episode, she'll be like, yeah, well, there's this thing that he can't account for, and it's so weird that he can't account for that. Now I feel like he definitely did it. And it's really interesting to watch her biases shift back and forth as she tries to dig through the available evidence and tries to sort of answer questions that the police and that the courts never seem to really address. It's just really interesting to look at. So, yeah, it's 12 episodes long. They're all between half an hour, depending on the episode. And yeah, I've really powered through it this week. Like, there is one episode left. I don't know what it's about, but I'm very interested in doing further reading because, like, the idea of taking, like, legal proceedings and breaking them down into very personable accounts on both sides and sort of trying to break down that whole process, like, I've learned a lot of stuff from that, even if I have no idea still if I believe this man did it or not.
I suppose the nice thing is that might not ultimately be the point if it's more of a...
Yeah.
It sounds like it explores things to a degree that actually this case could be anything as kind of held up as an example.
Yeah, I guess that. Like, it's interesting to look at. Like, even if you, like, can't make a decision one way or another about him, it's things like learn... there's one thing that I thought was, like... I'm like, this isn't too much of a spoiler. I'll talk about one thing. There are certain times where, like, he will talk about life inside prison and, like, his like, this person who's been arrested for murder, whether he did it or not, talks about, like, how he responded to being charged, like, at what point it started to become real for him. Like, the entire process is kind of fascinating to watch, and it's really interesting to see, like, what police will disregard and what they'll think is relevant when these cases happen. So yeah, it's just a really interesting look at that. I really do recommend it. That said, I haven't had a chance to do further reading because I haven't finished it yet. There could be huge flaws in her like journalistic process that I'm not aware of, but so far it seems like a really impressive like breakdown that is very aware of its own internal biases and tries very hard to acknowledge and correct them where possible, which is really interesting. So yeah. Did we have anything else this week to talk about?
Well, it's rather... I was trying to find some way of segueing, but I don't think I can.
No.
Because the main other thing I did this week was I finished my previous book, The Lies of Loch Lomora. Which is one of my favourite books of all time. And again, I've just realised I might not have mentioned that on the podcast. I kind of suck at talking about my absolute favourite things.
Well, that's all right. Go on. I want to hear about it. Go, go, go.
Okay, well, The Lies of Loch Lomora, I would thoroughly recommend anyway, and I'm amazed, like I say, amazed I haven't done so already. It's a book by Scott Lynch, and it's a kind of a con man caper kind of thing, in the style of Hustle, because I think that's where I draw my references from anyway, the BBC series. But set in a fantastical... It is an alien world. There are references to, like, Three Suns, for example. And a particular city on this world, which is clearly takes influences from Venice. But it's a city built around... like a forerunner alien race who've created this thing called Elder Glass, which is like impenetrable to human tools, and there is a subtle use of metal as well. But amongst all this, It's a city run very much on guilds and intrigue and this sort of juicy thing. And the culture there, that they have a pantheon of 12 known gods, and this 13th who is basically a god of thievery and things, all of which hides the fact that there's this gang of thieves basically ripping off the city without anybody knowing about it. And this band is called the Gentlemen Bastards, because they're all, for the most part, I think that they're all orphans, plucked into sort of like, and just been trained in thieving and conning. So yeah, the Lies of Loch Lamora sets up that world, and but it also has a very good, thrilling political change happening in the city and all the various events which spin off from that. It has some thoroughly well-written characters, and also a very rich world, which is usually what I look for in a book. So I've read it a couple of times, and I had the pleasure of meeting Scott Lynch, its author, actually at LunCon last year.
Oh, that's really cool.
And he turned out to be a fascinating and friendly individual. He also did a very interesting panel on creation of worlds. It was one of the few literature track items I went to. Simply like it was exploring influences from real world geography and things like that. Yeah, so I recommend The Lies of Loch Lamora. However, how I actually got onto that topic was the fact I'd finished that book. So I was actually going to talk about the fact I'm finally reading Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson. Is that one you've come
No, I
across?
have no idea what that is.
Well, it's one that I basically spent the entirety of my second life experience coming up against recommendations for this book. So finally getting around to it made me realize, oh, that's why people were talking about it. Because the second life thing is important. As far as I can tell, this is the book which put across certainly the word metaverse, but I think it is also the first book to really explore the idea of virtual worlds as we came to understand them in the form of Second Life. Because a few chapters in, you realize that the protagonist who the protagonist is actually called Hero Protagonist.
Is that what they're called in the game, or in that meta world, or
Well,
wow.
actually, that's an interesting question because he has that name in reality as well.
Okay.
It's never really explored, like whether he. I think he's adopted that name and kind of just made it his. But it's a cyberpunky enough world that that doesn't really matter. The metaverse has become integrated to a degree that people just roll with it. Like I say, I've used the keyword cyberpunk. It's near future, but kind of the thing I'm taking from it so far, having not quite finished yet, is the fact it's actually quite dated. So I should look up when it's actually written, but it does explore cyberpunk ideas, but it has things like it focuses particularly on couriers, deliverers of goods in an America which is fractured to the degree that individual suburbs are basically little conclaves that are run in quite corporate fashion. So you become a citizen basically of your neighborhood, and that this is run by a company or the mafia or something. And there are these couriers who deliver like between these rough neighborhoods, like to really fast and hard deadlines. And they're carrying like phones and then a separate device which combines something like a calculator and a compass. And it's little things like that just creep in to make me realize, oh yeah, this is actually quite old, isn't it?
It's yeah, it predates the idea of, oh, the smartphone that has everything in one device.
Which is something I don't come across that often in cyberpunk, but it is definitely starting to creep in. Because up until this point, I'd mostly read things like William Gibson, which manages to be just about non-specific enough that it's still believably in the future. So the likes of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep is sufficiently removed that you can still believe in this fantasy world that, yeah, well, what would happen if we had replicants wandering around and all this sort of thing, and how would that affect society? Whereas
Yeah.
something like Snow Crash is basically taking ideas we've now been living with for 10 years
Yeah.
and just putting it in this world where the mafia runs the USA, which is kind of harder to believe.
Ah, it's interesting, certainly. While we're on the topic, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep is on my to-read list. I have it in a pile of books to read. I've heard very good things about it, so I'm hoping to get around to it eventually.
It's a good one. It's surprisingly short, I feel. But what's interesting about it is, and I'm assuming you've seen Blade Runner.
Yes, I have.
Yeah. It's one of these books that I read and recognized. Like it does, Blade Runner definitely took like some key moments and certain lines from the book. But it still manages, it's actually sufficiently different to be really quite, well, different. I can't think of another word for that.
Sufficiently different to be different.
Yes, this may be the 48-hour game jam having kicked in.
That's fine. I'm doing game jam stuff. I'm doing game jam stuff while we do this podcast. I've just dropped into the chat for here. The sketches of roughly what we're trying to do with art style to be like, hey, lacking of detail, rough, quick sketches to do.
But it's nice now that actually, yeah, it's not great for podcasting, but
It's not
seeing
great
what
for
you've done with the
podcasting, but like,
colours.
yeah, I'll put this like in the show notes or something. We'll do something with it, but it's
We'll
like,
offer it up as a teaser for when you finish the game.
yeah. Well, this is the wonderful thing about game jam stuff. It's just like for this month long one, it's just every so often I'm like, I'm doing something else. I'll be like, oh, I can do game jam stuff while I'm here. Oh. It's actually forcing me to make games.
I was just going to say, actually, I looked it up, and actually, Snow Crash was written in nine. Oh, well, it was published anyway in 1992, which
It doesn't
again,
feel
like.
long ago.
No, but I'm reminded actually of when you were saying that you mentioned the fact the murder case was in like 99, which feels relatively recent, and then you're, oh yeah, that is 16 years ago, and
Yeah,
that's more than half my lifetime ago.
well, that's it. It's like you think 1992, that wasn't that long ago, but also that's over 20 years ago, and that's most of my life ago.
Yeah, when I think of what I was doing in 1992 and like the way the world was, actually,
Yeah.
yeah, Snow Crash would have looked pretty futuristic,
Okay,
considering the Mega
okay.
Drive had only been out for a few years.
I've been told I have to ask you a question on this week's podcast, and this is for the
Oh.
benefit of Tilly. Tilly wants to ask a question, and like, well, now's probably a good time to do it while we're talking about how like the progression of time is scary. You don't believe in the progression of time. You don't believe in time.
Yes. Okay, yeah,
Can we
this.
elaborate on this? Because I think like lots of people have been tweeting since that episode went up, being like, "So, Gemma doesn't believe in time. How does that work?"
Okay, I was not aware of that.
Yeah, I got a lot of tweets about that.
Basically, it's easy to say that I don't believe in the concept of time as usually put across in fiction, which tends to be how people on the street also tend to say it. This idea that time is a linear progression
Okay,
is
yeah.
just nonsense to me.
That's what I assumed you meant, and that makes a lot more
Yeah.
sense than like I don't believe in time in general, but yes, it's the idea of time as a linear constant that like is set and existent and that you know all the stuff that goes along with like time. It's an omnidirectional constant and
Yeah.
things.
I kind of do believe in, I guess my brain is going a little bit because it's actually sits in the same brain space as the one which holds false definitions of what a game is,
Have I
which
picked
I can
like the
come back
abs Have
to.
I picked the
But
absolute worst time when you're sleep deprived to try and ask you about
I think it's actually
issue?
the best because this is the perfect time to just whipple utter nonsense.
Okay, wibble some nonsense for a bit about your disbelief of time.
So like. It's more that I don't believe that the definition of time should be this linear thing. It's time to me is the human understanding of things which just happen, and it's easier to think of them in terms of sequences. But I, one of the things which actually sparked this off for me was the film Galaxy Quest. Have you seen
Okay,
that?
yeah.
Yeah, the Omega 13 machine, which is what. A device which can rearrange all the atoms of the universe back to what they were 13 seconds ago. And
Yes.
that, for me, is the only possible way we could do time travel, or our understanding of it, is simply taking a recording of where all atoms and molecules are in a given state, and then putting them back a bit. That would give us the experience of time travel, but wouldn't actually change anything. And so This is where my understanding of time falls down.
Time being relative is interesting as well, because like we have theories where time travel forwards can work if you have faster than light travel. And to do with like you can travel at such a speed that that time is traveling at a different speed for you relative to people who aren't moving relative, and like you can be gone from the Earth for a certain amount of time, but come back and a different amount of time has passed. Like, that's my thing. Like, my feelings on time is, like, I think that time is much like maths. It is an invention of humanity that makes existence much easier to understand, and the models we have for it work for, like, day-to-day life. Like, the models we have for how maths works, like, they're not innate, but we have rules that work for, like, almost every conceivable, like, standard human interaction with numbers works. And it's, like, it's very similar for time. It's, like, time is a human way of, like, contextualizing actions in relation to each other in a space where, like, because on Earth, time is moving, like, the same for everyone relatively. Like, everything's moving at a relative speed for everyone on Earth.
Until you do you co-host a 48-hour game jam, at which point time dilates to a great degree.
Yeah, there's that. Like, well, there's, like, the time dilation that happens in things like when I went up on stage with Gerard Way, where it's, like, I'm pretty sure that time slowed down, because, like, when he asked if it was me, he was like, I want you up on stage. And I said, what, me? And he said, yes. I was sure that was about 5 minutes. You watch it back, it's about 4 seconds and I'm already on the stage. Like, time does do different things. But, like, generally it's, like, it's a steadily accepted, like, constant that everyone is, like, it makes everything easier if we let this one thing that we're all looking at move around in a circle. And we base our life based on increments of that circle, be it the hands on a clock, or the planets around the sun, or the sun through the sky. Whatever movements it is, hey, this thing moves at the same speed for everyone. Let's base our day on how far that thing has moved.
Mm.
It's just a convenient constant.
Yeah, I can't help but quote Douglas Adams at this point from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, in that time is an illusion, lunchtime doubly so.
Yeah, it's a very convenient illusion, though, so, you know, I'm not going to tell people that, like, I'm not going to say to people, time is an illusion, let's do away with it. No, it's super useful. Let's keep it. Let's just be aware that it's not actually a thing.
And it does also end up one of those things where if you are in a severe state of tiredness or somehow high on whatever experience you're going through, it's the sort of thing you can just say and just freak people out. I don't believe in time.
Well, I like experiences that we have shared that made me not believe in time. You know, that first talk we both did, half of each at the first Nine Worlds. I started talking and then I blinked and my slot was over and I don't remember talking, but apparently half an hour had passed.
Yeah. Like,
time doesn't exist, because there is no way there was half an hour between me starting talking and finishing talking. Like, that was 2 minutes at most and I blinked and it was done and I don't remember it. I'm pretty sure half an hour just didn't exist, because time is weird like that.
Yeah, I've had precisely that experience actually in the same talk as well.
Hooray, a thing we both have.
And just because I inserted it as kind of a throwaway thing, like I say, it kind of fits in the same part of my brain as the concept of what a game is. But for me, that's sort of a linguistic thing as well, just because fundamentally I don't believe... I think the English language needs to come up with a better word for whatever games are.
Indeed, like I've talked about this many a time to be like... No one would do it, but, like, interactive experiences is probably a more accurate term that would encompass a lot more things that deserve to be encompassed by that term. Because, like, it's a weird linguistic thing where, like, the term game was, like, for video games was like just. It was first used to refer to a very specific type of experience, and the medium has evolved beyond a point where the connotations of that term really relate to the whole breadth of the medium anymore. Because it's like, hey, is game, which has connotations of fun and time-wasting experience for children, relevant to things like this war of mine, for example, and things like three-fourths time, where it's like hold down a button to drive home.
This feels like an ironic thing to bring up when I've just been on the Not a Game podcast. But yeah, it is basically that. To me, I always keep quiet on debates, or whatever. They're not even debates, I just end up slanging matches of whether a thing is a game or not. But that's because I hold two definitions of what a game is. If you're talking generally about, most people are talking to about games as interactive experiences, but depending on the definition, no, Gone Home, I don't believe it is a game. But it depends on the
Well,
context,
it's interesting, like,
because it
that.
doesn't have ludic agency and there aren't any rules,
Yeah,
so
exactly.
therefore.
It's like, there are some people that will use, like, the definition of does it have a win or loss state? Does it quantify your progression? Then you get into arguments about, like, okay, is the failure to see all of the content or the failure to reach the end of the, like, narrative a fail state? Like, if you just don't finish it, is that a fail state and does. Like, could you say for Gone Home? Gone Home has a fail state. The fail state is you don't get to the end. And then there's all these weird linguistic debates. Like, it's not a perfect comparison point, but it's like, hey, the rebranding of comics as graphic novels that was a thing that happened to try and change their perception. Is there any kind of similar thing we could do with video games to be like, hey, let's try calling them this thing? Most people will still call them the first thing, but it will, making a statement about how they're perceived.
Yeah, actually, what's interesting is that other languages have already, like, I don't know if they've even encountered that problem when speaking from the Swedish point of view, anyway. And actually, I think in German and quite a few German Germanic languages, the word is Serie, which looks written as just series.
And
It's just a
does that
reference
not
to a
have,
serial medium.
Does that not have like a direct translation? Is it just like a word unto itself for the medium, or is it like
Well, the direct t translation is either comics or graphic novels. I mean, I think we can also refer to comics as sequential art, which would be the more direct translation. But we don't use that because reasons, apparently.
It's interesting. Like, I'm sure it's a thing that will eventually get sorted, and like, it's a debate I don't much care for getting into repeatedly because it never goes anywhere.
Yeah, well, the sad thing is I do, because I'm a self-identified language nerd.
Well, I'm a language nerd that's like, oh, do I have to get into this fight again? Really? Really? Too much of it, but yeah, now's probably a good a time as any to start wrapping up for this week. It's been a really fun week, this one, actually, even if it's been a little bit different to normal. For anyone that's enjoyed this episode, where can people find you on the internet, Gemma?
You can generally find me at Raygun Goth on Twitter, where I link to my website, and then that's got everything else. It's worth saying you could also look us up, us being Global Game Jam Stockholm, at the Global Game Jam website, which is just globalgamejam.org, and you can look for locations there, narrow down to see like how many sites there were in Sweden and things. But you can also find us; we're the ones lurking in Stockholm, and you can also play all the games that were made there. They're all free to download and play and enjoy.
Hooray! As for me, I have a Patreon if you like my work and want to keep paying things like hosting fees for podcasts and stuff. So you can go to patreon.com/LauraKBuzz, and that's what pays the bills for my crazy long list of podcasts and things I do. Other than that, you can find me on Twitter at Laura K Buzz. You can listen to my variety of podcasts on iTunes or Google if you want. What do I do? The Indie Haven podcast, the Geek Night In category video games, Oh No Video Games, Laura's Destructoid Gaming Butts, the Podquisition. I'm soon going to be recording the pilot of a Steam Backlog podcast with Lauren, who we had on the podcast a few weeks back. And I've done a pilot for a show that's having its first episode soon, and I can't say any more about. So yeah,
You
that's.
tease.
Pardon?
You tease.
Oh, I know I'm a tease. I'm so horrible. So yeah, thank you very much for listening, everyone, this week. It's been lovely to have you all, and we will talk to you all again next week. Bye.
Bye.